And good afternoon, Richard.
Good afternoon, Kyle.
And here we are at Lopez Community Radio on Lopez Island. This is a pre-recorded program that you're going to be hearing, Richard Fagan and This Strange and Wonderful World. It's the second in our series of diving into the warm waters. And I'm going to let Richard talk a little bit more about that. Here we are in the middle of June, and which on the beginning of May Day seems a long way away, but I look forward to your hearing this in the warmer weather as Richard takes us diving into the warm water.
Thank you very much, Carol. You know, I mentioned last time that people have been free diving simply refers to diving without any kind of breathing apparatus, free diving for hundreds and hundreds, even several thousand years. We talked about a little bit about the Japanese Amas and the Polynesian divers, and in all of those early times, of course, they were always motivated by gathering something valuable. That was the idea, whether it was pearls or whether it was shellfish, whatever it was, the idea was that the ocean held treasures, and we wanted those treasures, and the only available way to get those treasures was just to take a deep breath, grab a stone or something, head down there, and take them. So it was a kind of hunting and gathering. Now, after the Second World War, and it was really only after the Second World War in any serious way, sport divers began to enter the fray, so to speak. And what they were mainly interested in, was catching fish. And although spearfishing has a rather bad name, it really is a rather, let's say, efficient way to harvest the ocean, because you actually, there's no bycatch. You see what you're going to kill, and hopefully what you kill, you eat. So it's the most selective of all ways of fishing. So my own feeling is that there's nothing wrong with spearfishing, and in fact, that it's a rather, as I say, decent way of fishing, particularly if you're not taking unfair advantage of the fish, which is to say, as long as you're free diving and swimming around with them sort of on more or less equal terms. Now, it was after the Second World War, when I was in the service, that I was introduced to spearfishing. And I was introduced when I was in the Army, stationed in Puerto Rico, and since I very much enjoyed the water, had done some scuba diving and some free diving, the question was, well, why not catch some fish while we're at it? Because I'd always liked conventional fishing when I was a kid. So armed with very, very simple hunting devices, the most simple is just a spear and a pole with a spear point at the end of it, and on the other end there is a piece of surgical tubing attached in a loop, and you can stretch that tubing, put your hand up on the spear, and when you let go of the spear, almost like a slingshot, the surgical tubing will propel the spear forward with some force. Now with that, you have to get very close to a fish. You basically almost have to touch the spear point to the fish. But in the Caribbean in the mid-1950s, the fish hadn't seen much of this, and they weren't particularly frightened of people, and you could usually get a pretty good catch that way. And in fact, an officer, I was an enlisted man, but an officer and I formed a spearfishing team, which was a sort of mildly regulated kind of competitive activity, and we fished against the Navy and the Air Force, also stationed in Puerto Rico.
So what branch of the service were you in then?
I was in the Army.
You were in the Army.
I was in the Army, yeah. I was drafted.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, such as it was, he and I won the Caribbean Spearfishing Championship, which made the Navy very angry since we were in the Army.
Yeah, I know. That's why I got a little confused there. You spent a lot of time, sometime in the water in the Army.
Yeah. And the way in which those tournaments were conducted was really very simple. There were two-person teams. They lasted 4 hours. There were certain fish that you could catch and that you could not catch that were legal. You didn't hunt for reef fish, the sort of beautifully colored tropical fish and things like that. But the more open water fish like groupers and snappers and things like that. Barracuda were difficult to catch, but they were fair game. At the end of the 4 hours, the team that had the most poundage won. So one of the things you did was look for nice-sized fish, 3 and 4 pounders, and try and get a lot of them, not just hope for the big guy. Anyway, we did that, and I still have some fond memories of those spearfishing days. I haven't spearfished since then, so it's more than 50 years ago. Just in passing, I'll say, we typically fished at about, down to about 60 feet. We didn't go deeper than that. So you'd stay on the surface for a little while, take some deep breaths, go down to 60 feet or 30 feet if you found fish there, hunt, come back up, toss the fish in the boat, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, but we were pikers, not really big time. The big time guys, most of whom were from California or from Italy, or from the Spaniards were also in on it. Anyway, and the French, of course, the big time guys were fishing at 90 and 100 feet. And what happened is that, in a way, out of this spearfishing competition came the idea that, well, why spearfish? Why not just see how deep we can go? How deep can you dive without, let's say, auxiliary oxygen or air or anything like that? So what started out in a sense as a spearfishing competition ended up or morphed into a deep diving competition. And this is what we're going to talk about. But before we do that, I want to say something about the deep diving marine mammals and other beasts, because these guys really can dive. The statistics are really quite unbelievable. The two champion deep diving mammals are the sperm whale and the northern elephant seal. The sperm whale is he's the gold medal winner. They attach devices to these animals to find out, you know, to trackers, depth gauges that send back signals and things like that. The sperm whale has been tracked to 6,500 feet. In other words, 6,500 feet, well over a mile down, and an immersion time of an hour or more from the time it leaves to the time it gets back.
So what is it about their body structure that allows them to withstand that?
We'll talk about that in just a second.
I'm always ahead of you there.
You're always ahead of me, Carol.
My curiosity, you're anticipating the curiosity.
Okay. Okay, the silver medal is held by the northern elephant seal. That beastie has been tracked to 5,000 feet and 2 hours underwater. Now, if we go to the reptiles, the gold medal winner is the leatherback turtle. He goes to 3,000 feet, or she, and can stay 40 minutes. And as for birds, it's not surprisingly the emperor penguin will go to 2,000 feet and only stay about 20 minutes. Now, that doesn't mean that these beasts, the mammals, the reptile, and the bird, always are going to those depths. These are the deepest depths that they've been tracked at. And so, Carol, as you wisely, sagely asked, how the devil do they do it? And now we're talking about the mammals, not the reptile. Because right. They have the same organs we have. They have a heart, they have a brain, they have a circulatory system, they have lungs, they're air breathing, etc., etc. Well, they do it through four basic mechanisms, or there's four things that happen when they dive deep. Their metabolism and their pulse slow way down. Here are statistics from Weddell seals, who are deep divers, but nothing like the elephant seal we've been talking about. At the surface, the pulse, the Weddell seal, 110.
Just a minute, Richard. I did it again, and this time I caught it. We have to start over. It's recording. He'll cut this out. Let's just keep going.
Okay, it is recording.
It is recording. And I'll ask him to cut it out.
Okay.
Sorry.
Right. Yeah, No problem. Anyway, it gives me a chance to clear my throat. Here we go. Back on. Okay. First thing that happens is the metabolism and the pulse slow way down. The wet-eyed seals go from 110 on land to 68 when they first dive to 3 beats a minute at depth. So their hearts are barely working at depth. Just 3 times every, 20 seconds the heart beats. And the blood flow, which of course is much reduced because the heart's only beating 3 times a minute, goes to the brain, basically to the brain. Because if the brain doesn't get the oxygen, the animal dies. So automatically, obviously there's no thought involved in any of this, automatically the pulse slows way down. The second thing that happens is that the lungs collapse at pressure. They don't collapse completely, but they fill with fluid. Because at these extreme depths, of course, the pressures are tremendous. And our bodies, and the marine mammal bodies, are basically not compressible except for a few areas. The lungs, which are filled with air. In our cases, the sinuses and other, the trachea and the upper respiratory system. Those are the areas where there's air and where things can be compressed. And so those areas have to be protected because they can only collapse so much. And the way they're protected is that they get filled with liquid. So the lungs collapse at pressure, and this also has the benefit to the animal that the nitrogen absorbed into the blood is less than if the lungs were full of air. Because the nitrogen can get only get into the blood through the lungs. And if the lungs are collapsed and basically not working, and the oxygen is otherwhere, you don't take as much nitrogen in. And the third thing that happened is that these mammals can store oxygen in their muscles, in their musculature, in the form of myoglobin, which is a protein which binds oxygen. So they have lots of oxygen in the muscles, where the oxygen is both useful, but it's also protected. Mm-hmm. And, for example, the emperor penguins, now we're back to birds, have about 50% of their oxygen in their muscles. We humans, have about 15% in our muscles. And finally, they don't really swim to these depths. They sink or coast or glide down. And the secret to this, and I've had this experience myself, is that if you go down, and you don't have to go down very far, and the lungs start to collapse, your total buoyancy lessens because you're occupying less space. And if you're only slightly positive buoyancy, you can go to negative buoyancy. And when you're at negative buoyancy, you sink automatically. You don't have to push your way down.
That makes sense. I never thought of that.
Yeah. And so they glide, this is particularly true of the whales, as their lungs collapse, as their buoyancy lessens, which say their specific gravity rises, they glide to depth, and they're not using much energy at all. Maybe the tail is flicking just a little bit, but these big, powerful movements that the whales make are gone, and they're just gliding. Now, there's the downside of that. They can't get back to the surface by gliding, so they have to power up. So they have to have enough oxygen left in their systems to power up. So, just to summarize about the marine mammals, they're amazingly efficient users of oxygen. They protect by blood shift, the one organ that is absolutely essential for survival, which is the brain, and they manage the pressure by simply letting these gas-filled spaces, of which there are a few, the stomach has, and the intestine has gas in it, and the lungs, of course, and the trachea have gas in it. They simply let them collapse. They fill with fluid to some extent, and at that point they become uncompressible. So they're able to stand the pressure, to return to your original question, because basically they are now an all-fluid organism.
Right.
They're not a fluid and gas organism. They're all fluids. And at that point, they can't be squashed anymore.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, back to the humans. excuse me. I'm getting short of breath from this discussion.
Talking about breath.
Now, okay. Now, here, we're back to us. Hold your breath. You, me, any of these listeners. And pretty soon, you have to breathe, right? I remember my children, you know, would, one of my daughters in particular would have, you know, a fit, and she'd hold her breath, and she'd hold her breath. But she couldn't pass out or anything. Like that. Sooner or later, she just had to breathe. And why do you have to breathe? Because carbon dioxide, as a part of the process, obviously, of living, builds up in the lungs. There's a trigger in the sympathetic nervous system, which you can't control, which forces you to breathe. So when the carbon dioxide reaches a certain level in your lungs, depending on what kind of shape you're in, you got to breathe. Nothing you can do about it. Not quite true, as we'll see. In an ordinary, fairly sedentary person, when the carbon, when about, I would say, between 1/4 and 1/3 of the oxygen that's in your lungs has been used, the carbon dioxide has built up to the point that you have to breathe. That's why when you are trapped underwater or drowned, you don't die. Because you have all this residual oxygen, which is still there, and it'll feed the brain for some time. And then when all of that residual oxygen is used up, at that point, you're brain dead, and you can't come back. So there's a big safety cushion built in there in terms of this mechanism of carbon dioxide building up, having to breathe when there's still lots of oxygen left for an emergency. Now, here's the kicker. This urge to breathe, this need to breathe, you can control it through training, through meditation. And the great fakers who could hold their breath for these long periods of time, Houdini, who could be put into water, you know, for a long period of time, they had all learned how to control through relaxation and meditation the carbon dioxide buildup trigger. As you can imagine, this is extraordinarily dangerous, which means that if you're highly trained this way, you can kill yourself by holding your breath. And I will now tell a small story about something that happened to me. When I was doing all this spearfishing and freediving, I had no idea about any of this. But I was training myself sort of intuitively by mild hyperventilation, where you just before you go down, and by relaxation, so that to use as little energy as possible. I was thinner then. I was in a situation where if I got 6-7 feet below the surface of the water, I would become neutral and then negative buoyant, so I could go down to depth with very little. I just point myself in the right direction and I'd sink, etc. One day, I speared a rather big red snapper. My guess is 25, 30 pounds, something like that. These snappers often hid in caves down on the sandy bottom. My guess is, since we didn't have depth gauges, that it was 55, 60 feet down there. I speared him in the cave. As a defensive mechanism, or I don't know, just an instinctual mechanism, they would spread their gills, which made them impossible to pull out of the cave because now they're like a cork in a bottle. You couldn't get them in. The only thing that you could do is wait, and maybe even spear them again with a second spear or something like that, until finally they expired, relaxed, you pulled them out. And so I was negatively buoyant. It was a beautiful sandy bottom. This big red snapper was in the cave. The spear was in him. I just put my spear gun down, and I lay down on the sand, and I looked at him. And I thought, Mr. Snapper, as long as you want to wait, I'll wait with you. And I waited, I don't know how long, and all of a sudden, like a bolt of lightning, it hit me. I'm down here, and I'm not feeling any shortness of breath. And this is too weird. I mean, all this happened in a fraction of a second, and I better get out of here and get out of here quickly. quickly. I left everything there. I swam to the surface. I made it to the surface gasping for breath, but otherwise unharmed. And what had happened is that, quite unknown to me, I had passed through that barrier just by relaxation and meditation and eyeballing Mr. Grouper and talking to him silently. I had gone into using that residual oxygen. And if I'd stayed down there long enough, if I hadn't snapped out of it, I would have drowned.
Right.
So,
and you also may have been able to stay down there a bit longer because you left that meditative state, so
yeah.
to say, as soon as you became aware.
And where? That's right.
That
and
moment.
Then,
you,
and then
it was no
I
longer
was,
available.
I was aware. I was terribly short
yeah.
of breath.
Wow.
Anyway.
Fascinating.
That's my fishing story for
that's
the day.
That's fascinating,
yeah.
though.
Now, we are, after all, mammals, and we are not unrelated to creatures of the sea, although there are many steps, if you're a Darwinian anyway, between the sperm whale and us, or between the dolphin and us. Anyway, but these mechanisms that I talked about exist in us in attenuated form, exist in human beings. For instance, pulse can slow down underwater. One of these deep divers who's been very extensively monitored, his pulse during one of these deep sort of meditative dives dropped from 80 to 18. Same as the mammals, the lungs collapse. And the same diver, who's a big husky guy, his chest circumference measured 50 inches at the surface, which is big chest, 20 inches at great depth. I have asked various physicians and surgeons about this, and they say it seems to them that it is possible that there's enough flexibility in the rib cartilage in a young person so that that change in circumference could take place. It seems absolutely unreal to me
yeah.
that this massive chest could be reduced
collapse,
to that.
Literally.
Could collapse. That's it.
And then regenerate.
That's right. Without breaking ribs yeah. and things like that. But they say it is mm-hmm. possibly about it. The spleen, which carries a lot of oxygen in it, releases its oxygen, well, oxygen-carrying hemoglobin, to the bloodstream. So you call on spleen-stored oxygen.
So you have it. We always have that storage
right,
available.
Right, that storage. And here, to me, the creepiest thing at all, and we'll get back to this, that fluids, including inhaled seawater, can fill cavities that otherwise would be crushed by the pressure. Now, forgetting about inhaled seawater for a moment, blood is forced into the heart and brain. The trachea fills with fluids from the body. I assume that it's lymphatic fluids to keep it from being completely crushed. You, of course, can't wear a mask or eye protection of any kind because that trapped air would be compressed and whatever you have on would be crushed against your eyeballs. Some people who do this do wear flooded goggles, but I'm not sure why. So they just flood the goggles, and then that becomes not compressible. It spreads the pressure a little bit onto the skeletal structure, maybe, and takes it, not all of it, right onto the eyeball. Now, this trachea crush, again, I didn't know about any of that, and I never experienced it when I was young and in good shape. But on our various expeditions, when I would do a little very modest free diving, you know, to 30 feet or something like that, I began to feel the trachea pressure because the muscles in the trachea and all that was much weaker, you know, at 65 than it was at...
Well, like a choking sensation?
It felt exactly like someone had their hands on my throat and they were choking me.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
what I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. Quite yeah. unpleasant.
Yes, very unpleasant.
Now, so now that we know that we have at least some of these mechanisms in play, like a marine mammal, although not as extreme, I'm going to read you from a memoiristic account by one of the all-time great free divers, a Cuban-American who goes by the name of Pipin. It's a nickname. And this has an almost mystical element to it. He's sort of a mystical guy, but it seems that this isn't BS, that this is, you know, a fair report. as to what's going on with him. Now, he is, as this story starts, he's at 100 meters. He's at 330 feet down. We'll get there in a moment of how he gets to 330 feet. Here he is, and he's writing about his experience at 330 feet down. The battle to compensate the middle ear gets worse. This is the battle to equalize pressure that we've probably all experienced, even in a swimming pool or in an airplane descending from 5,000. You know, it's that pressure. Okay, it gets worse. I make a last effort to equalize, and it's finally successful, giving me confidence for what comes next. After equalizing, I contract my diaphragm and can now feel my lungs completely full of blood plasma, which is what happens to any marine mammal that submerges to this depth. At this point, I give thanks to my heart, which for the entire descent has been pumping blood into my lungs to prevent them from collapsing under the pressure. This heart is able and experienced. It knows that blood is a liquid and that liquids are not compressible. The described phenomena is called blood shift, and it's one of the innumerable atrophied aquatic capabilities that man possesses. This is my parentheses. Now, as you can see, this is one of those guys, and there are a number of them, who really are looking for the links between us as mammals and the marine mammals from which we may have descended. Continuing. Now I realize that the 8.2 liters of air which I inhaled and departed with at the surface have been reduced to almost a quarter of a liter. That small amount is lodged in my nasal passages and my eustachian tubes, given the quantity of equalizations I've had to perform to compensate my ears and evade the pain generated by the increasing hydrostatic pressure and the traumatic compression of the body. At 105 meters down, I again check my compensation, blowing as hard as I possibly can to further equalize, but nothing happens. The difference of 5 meters has squeezed the remaining air so much that it's virtually non-existent. Then I decide to call upon one of my greatest discoveries. It's the solution to an obstacle that confronted me in the beginning. I take off my nose plug and let water flood my nasal passages. This forces the remaining tightly compressed air from the sinuses to the internal ears, equalizing the air spaces. From this moment on, I will not have to make another attempt to equalize because it will be automatic. Compensation in the open, flooded cavities leading from my nose to my ears will be gradual as I descend. 116 meters. From now on, everything is psychological. The domination of the mind, my mind, without which my body would be a useless mannequin. My heart slows to 14 beats per minute. It knows that each contraction consumes a great quantity of energy, and that if it were to tire out, we would be in extreme difficulty. But at the same time, it knows never to stop pumping blood to my cerebral cortex, and with the power of my mind, I can control a direct and efficient relationship between the two organs. So he's floating around down there at 350 feet.
With almost total consciousness of his inner body. Sorry, folks, we're just going to... I can't turn this off. It'll go off. We got a little telephone call here, and now we're going to proceed. Here we are, deep down in the water.
Yeah, we're at about 350 feet now.
And this guy, it's amazing.
And everything's flooded with seawater up to the nose.
He is a mystic. I mean, they're
Absolutely a mystic. And these people are, because the meditative stage you have to go through to prepare yourself with it is taken directly from yogic relaxation, from Eastern mysticism, et cetera, and breathing techniques. Now, how deep are these folks going? Well, we have to look at the categories of competition, because there are categories of competition. One is called constant ballast, and that's what we understand by the old free diving. It means that whatever you swim down with, you swim up with. This is the old free diving, okay? You swim down and you swim up. You can't use a stone to take you down.
Right, and then leave it.
You can't do anything like that. You swim down and you swim up. There's something called variable ballast. We're not going to deal with that. It's not very interesting. And then there's something called no limits. And this is really a different game. A cable is put down. Okay. Well, there's usually a cable to guide people. But in constant ballast, you can't touch it. It's just a guide so that you know you're going up. Yeah, you have a visual thing. In no limits, there is a sled, which is a device that looks, what does it look like? It doesn't look like a snow sled or anything like that. It's basically like a T-bar lift, maybe on. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you wrap yourself around that T-bar lift, and you are carried to the bottom by a weight, or carried to the depth by a weight. So you're basically sitting on this T-bar, and you go to the bottom, and you can have, I've seen pictures of them. He sits there like a Buddha with his arms folded and, pulled down by the T-bar. Okay. When you get to the bottom, you have with you an airbag. And that airbag has a small cylinder of compressed air with it. And you, you inflate that airbag and that gives you now positive buoyancy because you're hanging on to this airbag. And this airbag, which of course then expands as it gets higher, as the pressure gets lower on it, carries you to the surface at a very substantial rate of speed. So that by the time you get to the surface, you actually break out of the water sort of like a missile, and come up and splash back in again. So that's no limits. You can use any mechanical device you want to get down, and you can use any mechanical device you want to get up, but you must be holding your breath the whole time, okay? Now, here are what the current records are. The constant ballast, which is the swim down, swim up in the old-fashioned way, is at 367 feet. That is the operating depth of a World War II submarine. And, I was proud of myself at 60 feet, which you can see 1/6 of this. And with every time you go down another 60 feet, it becomes more difficult. It's not like it's constantly difficult.
No,
it's more difficult.
Yeah,
so 367 feet for men held by an Austrian. For women, it's 295 feet held by a woman from the United Kingdom. The no limits, which was what was being described by Pippin earlier, the sled down and then the airbag up. It's now at 702 feet, an Austrian, same Austrian, and for women, 524 feet. I must say that in terms of records, of various kinds, across Antarctica, unsupported, Everest without oxygen, these kinds of extreme things. This seems to me the most unlikely of all, that someone can go down with a single breath of air to 702 feet and come back, no matter what's helping them, or for that matter, swim down to 367 feet.
Well, it requires complete awareness and control over one's own internal body functions. Yeah. That's really, as a Western thinker, pretty unimaginable.
Yeah, and it goes without saying that quite a few people have died attempting these things. Because the limit for error, the tolerance for error, is close to zero. Because although there are safety divers down there, some of them breathing these mixed gases and on rebreathers so they can be down at these depths, nevertheless, when you've taken down your lung full of air, which is now compressed to sort of, the size of a pack of cigarettes or something like that, even if a safety diver were to put a mouthpiece in your mouth, it's unlikely that you could take a breath.
Right.
And if they force the air in, they just rupture things. So the safety divers are there mainly as observers.
Right. So they
they're,
know.
They're not, I know of no example of a rescue from these depths.
It's not a.
So there's no coming back. Oh, we're very popular this morning.
We really are. I don't know what these people know what I'm doing. I don't do that.
Yeah. Now, there's another, in addition to the obvious problem of going to those depths, there's another danger, and more people have died from this than from not returning from the depth. As you get nearer to the surface, of course, you are, the amount of residual oxygen you have left is obviously less and less and less and less. So what's getting to your brain is oxygen starved. It's not rich. It's not oxygen rich in the sense that a normal breath of air is. And so if that oxygen, when you get close to the surface, is too low in your brain, there's what they call shallow water blackout. And quite a few divers trying these kinds of things have blacked out and died within 20 feet of the surface because they go unconscious and then they sink again. Yeah. So
I can well imagine that. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So perhaps the greatest of all danger zones is the last 30 or 40 feet, particularly if you're not being carried up mechanically, if you're free diving.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, when was that record set?
Oh, they gets broken all the time. It's 2008, and for all I know, I haven't checked.
Yeah.
These are all 2008 records.
That's what I'm curious.
Yeah. I think I took these from the 2009 Guinness Book of Records, and they were set in 2000. And undoubtedly, they'll change. They won't change by huge increments. You know, someone will go to, instead of 702 feet, they'll go to 715 feet or something like that. But that's the nature of those competitions. Now, final question to all of us. Why do they do it? I mean, it's one thing what I used to do. I mean, we were fishing. We were sort of macho boys, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There was a little competition mixed in, but it was all sort of good fun in a way. And really not terribly dangerous. I know of no one who was hurt on any of these kinds of things that we did. Why do they do it? Well, since I'm not of that breed, never have been, don't have that mentality, I don't have a good answer to that, except to say, why do the mountain climbers continue to put up, as they say, much more difficult ruts on mountains that have already been climbed, or climb without oxygen, or climb all 8 of the tallest peaks without oxygen? Why do the free rock climbers are now trying solo free ascents, contemplating of places like Half Dome? A solo free ascent means that you are just climbing. There's no safety rope. There's no nothing. You're climbing a 3,000 face foot monolith, and the probability of dying on there is certainly high.
Right.
Because one slip, you fall, and you're dead.
Right. And you're just working with handholds and footholds. That's
handholds
it.
Handholds and footholds. And
I mean, no iron, but you can get in the rock.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, why do they do that? I don't have an answer to that. I mean, no one has yet climbed Half Dome in that kind of descent, but someone's going to try very soon. That's clear. So, if anybody out there can explain it to me, what drives these machos, and increasingly women too, because it's by no means, you know, a gender-specific kind of thing, I would love to have it explained, because I recognize in myself all kinds of, let's say, fantasies, stupidity, and things, but never any urge to try and go down to 350 feet. You know, fitting down and fitting back up. So I don't get it. But it's part of our strange and wonderful world.
It certainly is. And fortunately, it's a world that we're curious about and seeking both what other people have experienced and more information about what drives us humans to the places we go. Yes. And so this concludes this month of June. Programs on this strange and wonderful world. Do we know yet what's ahead? Or,
well, let me see. And this may just be a guess, but let me check something.
Yeah, sure. And while Richard's checking, I'll tell you that this is KLOILP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And we're here with Richard Fagan on the Strange and Wonderful World, and toward the end of June. And what's next?
Okay. Well, we haven't actually gotten to the Pacific yet. I mean, yeah, we've only sort of gotten our feet wet and a little more of us wet. So I thought that maybe next time I'd talk about Polynesian navigation because it's really quite a wonderful navigational system. It's quite an achievement, the fact that the Polynesians managed to spread themselves all the way from New Zealand to Hawaii, what we know as Hawaii, and down to Easter Island, covering a big chunk of the biggest ocean on Earth. And so I thought I'd talk about Polynesian navigation.
Wow, that's great. Another adventure stories looking back into the warmer waters. And thank you so much, Richard, and have a good afternoon. You'll be hearing some music next.